Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to Foment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts on this weekly journey in all things fermentable on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Also archived on iTunes and Stitcher.
So what do we have this week, Chris?
Well, actually, it's the last few days that you can sign up for Homebrew Alley 8. It's one of the largest competitions on the East Coast, homebrew competitions. And go to homebrewalley.com for more information. The deadline for registering your beers and also for getting your beers to New York City is January 31st. Also coming up in late February, we have New York City Beer Week starting on February 21st, and we're going to have a giant showcase and a fun grand old time at Grand Central Terminal. And it's the first time Grand Central Terminal, their Vanderbilt Hall, has ever hosted a beer festival at all of this kind. So we're super psyched about this.
And that's a grand opening bash on Friday,
February 21st. That's Friday, February 21st. That's right, Friday, February 21st at Grand Central Terminal. We're super psyched. It's a lot of work has gone into this. It's going to be an awesome bash and have some really fun music happening. And we have a sick beer lineup from brewers of all kinds.
So Chris and I actually just got off the plane. We're now in Hong Kong, but we wanted to bring you this special show. This is actually pre-taped at a Virtue Cider tasting at Jimmy's Number 43 back in October of 2013 during New York Cider Week. We were very lucky to attend. Greg Hall, who is the owner and head cider maker of Virtue Cider, led us through a tasting and really, you know, gave some great insights on cider making in America and the history, etc. You'll also hear Steve Woods, who's the owner of Poverty Lane Orchards and Farnham Hill in New Hampshire. And you're going to hear Jimmy Carbone from Jimmy's Number 43 and Beer Sessions Radio as well in the background. So welcome as we learn some more about cider.
Maybe some cackling from me.
Definitely.
My background being a craft brewer, I started in craft brewing in 1988. My father was kind enough to open up a brewery for me to work at called Goose Island. So I worked there from 88 until just a couple years ago, 2011, when we ended up selling the business, and I decided I kind of followed my heart toward the orchard and decided I wanted to make cider. I really first got into cider in the year 2000 when I took a trip with six of my colleagues at Goose Island over to England to visit English breweries, and on our last couple days there, we were up in the city of York and visited a great pub called the Maltings. Anybody been to the Maltings? Great pub. But they were doing a cider fest, much like we're doing here today. But they had 40 different casks of cider from all around the country on tap. And we decided we wanted to taste every single one of them. And before that day, I was cider ignorant. I thought cider was either cold and sweet and brown in the fall and delicious, or not quite as brown and not quite as sweet, and certainly not quite as delicious, and served at 5 a.m. in Irish bars when soccer games were going on. So that's what I thought of cider. And then all of a sudden, I tasted all these wonderful ciders, and my palate opened up, and I kind of felt like the guys I would make fun of who came into Goose Island and asked if we made any domestic beer. You know, I was the ignorant one. And I tasted all this, and it really got me excited about it. And we always said at Goose Island we were going to make cider one day, and it never happened. So when the company changed hands, it was a great opportunity for me to go off and make cider. The other really thing that inspired me is I've got a lot of friends in the chef community in Chicago, and I would see them every Wednesday and every Saturday at the local farmers market, the Green City Market. And they're buying their carrots and their onions and their cauliflower and their greens and everything directly from their farmers, which I thought was just so wonderful. And as a brewer, I got to go out to the Yakima Valley and select hops every September. So I'd go out there and I'd rub out all these bales of hops and sniff them, and we'd pick our hops. We'd go out and walk the fields with the growers. I'd be out there for 2 days and I'd leave and I wouldn't come back for another year. And you don't really, as a brewer, you don't participate in agriculture really at all. You know, you're buying agricultural products, but most brewers aren't lucky enough to know where their hops come from, and aren't very few know where their barley comes from. They buy malt. The maltster doesn't even know where their barley comes from because they buy it from a co-op. So as a cider maker in Michigan, we like know our growers by name. They live in our community. We get and see them in the springtime when the fields are in bloom. We visit them all during the year and break bread with them, drink coffee with them when it's cold in the morning, and drink cider with them at night. So it's great to be part of the agricultural community. And I think there's no adult beverage that is as agricultural as cider is. It's just so agricultural. We are starting to grow a little bit of fruit on our farm. We put in 400 trees this past year. Anybody who's not a cider maker are like, 400 trees, wow! Anybody who is a cider maker is like, 400 trees? Steve, how many trees do you have?
15,000.
15,000, right. Right. So, right. Right. Yes, he knows everyone by name.
Yeah, exactly.
How's Uncle Larry doing?
Cut Uncle Larry down.
So it's really fun to be part of the cider community. We make one of the things we wanted to do from the start was make a range of ciders. And as a brewer, one of the things I noticed when I went over to Europe and visited breweries, I'd go to England and the English brewers would be like, yeah, we make the good beer, the German beers are all boring, and the Belgian beers are all infected. And I'd go to Germany and they'd be like, we make the good beer, the English beers are all kind of warm and flat and bitter, and the Belgian beers are all infected. And the Belgians would say, our beer is good, and the, you know, so on and so forth. And I kind of feel like it's the same way with cider makers. And I was just at this cider tasting, and there was an English cider maker there who I won't name, but he's like, I really can't drink this Spanish stuff. I can't drink it. It's too much. I like it. I like it all. I think it's great. And I think that's what makes America great, is like, we make every kind of beer, we make every kind of cheese, we make every kind of cuisine, and, you know, at least what we're trying to do at Virtue is make every kind of cider. So we got three different nations represented with what we're pouring today. We think the three main cider countries. We think the English ciders, you know, to really give you the Reader's Digest version, English ciders tend to be a little more apple forward and have a little more tannin in the finish. Steve, you concur there? French ciders tend to be not apple forward. They tend to be more fermentation forward, and they tend to be a little sweeter and rounder in the finish. They can be tannic. They can be softer, but they. And then the Spanish ciders are completely different, and I think they're all wonderful in their own way. I think one of the big differences about making beer and making cider, obviously, you got apples versus barley and hops. But when you're making beer typically to a recipe. You pick your ingredients, you measure them out, you control your process, and you make your recipe. And then at the end of the day, or the week, or the month, whenever your beer is ready, you get an expected beer out of that batch. Cider is completely different. Cider, when you're making cider, you're taking the apples and pressing them and fermenting them, and they become a component of a cider. Most pretty much all the English ciders, French cider makers I've met, they blend. That's the real art of cider making. That's when they make their cider, is when they blend it. So you're really focusing on letting the apples kind of go their way. You press the apples. Sometimes they're going to be a little more acidic. Sometimes they're more tannic. Sometimes they're more aromatic. But they're different all the time. Every apple on every tree is going to be a little bit different. They're different with the seasons. They're different early season, late season. They're different from different orchards. You just can't make the exact same cider time after time when you're using different apples from different orchards at different times in the season. So some of us don't even try. We just try to make the best cider we can and let the apples kind of go the way they want to go. And then once they get there, we say, okay, we'll blend some of this and put it together, and it'll fit with what we're trying to get to. So the first cider we've got is a cider called Red Streak, right?
Yeah.
So Red Streak is our English dry cider. We actually make three different ciders to make this. Each one with a different set of apples and a different yeast, cultivated yeast. We ferment them independently, and then we blend it together, and then we add some. With that, we age some of that in American oak, new American oak barrels, about 10%, and blend that back in. So, in many ways, it's more complex a process than any beer I ever made as a brewer, because we're making three independent ciders. Then we barrel age some of it, then we blend it, but the blend is never like a ratio. It's all the taste every time, because they're all, each component is going to be a little bit different. So it should start with a good amount of apple on the nose. It's got a lot of acidity. Got a little bit of a barrel in the back end. Question? Yes. Every cider that we make touches wood. So we have not Steve Wood.
He'll be here all week.
Right. So we have in our shop about 550 barrels. We have a range of different types of barrels. We've got new American oak barrels, which are full of tannin. And the cider that comes out of those new American oak barrels tastes like drinking furniture. It's so crazy tannic. So that's what we put in Red Streak at only about 10%. So you get a little bit of that tannin, but it's not crazy. We use some French oak. Some French oak used wine barrels from California. Some that are that have been aged with white wine. We use that for one cider. We use some that are aged with red wine, and then we also use some that have been rejected from the winery because they show positive for a wild yeast called Brett. Anybody know what Brett is?
Yeah.
Yay. So, yes, when they said we're rejecting some barrels for Brett, we say, me. We want all of those barrels. So we've got a bunch of those, and we'll tell you about how we use those a little bit. And we also get some American bourbon barrels that are American oak. We have a relationship with a distiller called Heaven Hill, and we get typically 12-year-old barrels from Heaven Hill and age cider in those. So we use all kinds of different wood products to age our cider in. Now, this is not made with any traditional cider fruit. This is made with heritage North American fruit like Northern Spy, Ida Red, Macintosh, some English fruit like Cox Orange Pippin. So there's a lot of different fruit in here, but the base of this is a fruit called Northern Spy, which is very prevalent in northern Michigan. We use a lot of that. And then we use a lot of Macintosh because of all the apples we've tried, it's the most aromatic. We really like that one. Excellent. Okay, so who's ready for the next cider? And what I miss most about brewing is brewers, the guys that I got to brew with. I miss all those guys. I still talk to a lot of them pretty regularly, but we had a great crew at Goose Island, and I miss a lot of those guys. Many of them are still there. Many of them have gone on to other breweries. you know, all over the country. Southern Tier here in New York. It's run by an old Goose Brewer. Firestone Walker out in California. Bell's has got a bunch of Goose guys. Lagunitas has got a bunch of old Goose guys. About half the breweries in the Chicago area have a bunch of Goose guys. Revolution is 100% old Goose guys. So Off Color is ex-Goose guys. So Penrose Brewing, ex-Goose guys. So there's.
So like, when you went to England, for example, what are some of the cider makers in England that you got to work with or you appreciate their product?
Well, there's a lot of great cider makers in England. I gravitate more to the small guys than the big guys. You know, Tom Oliver is kind of my mentor over there.
Yeah, Tom Oliver.
Yeah. Tom Oliver, love.
Love him.
So I was fortunate enough to do a couple of collaborations with Tom. I think you guys supported the Gold Rush here before. So that's a cider that he made over in England after we had a night of drinking. And my contribution to that was sending him a JPEG of our logo that he could put on the back of his label. So that's about how much of a collaboration it was. And then this year he came over and helped us blend the Ledbury cider, which is another one of our English ciders, which we made with Steve Wood's juice. So that was kind of a three-way collaboration.
So what percentage of your juice is outsourced versus your homegrown orphans?
We don't. Right now we have 400 trees that are sticks. So we have no apples right now. So yeah, part of our mission is to support local agriculture. And I was talking to a pig farmer, Mr. Pig Farmer. Is it Dan the pig farmer?
Mike
the pig farmer. Wave, pig farmer. Wave, yes. So, you know, one of the things that we feel real strongly about is, you know, not only do we want to make great cider, but we want to help change kind of the agricultural climate. And we want to have farmers, you know, we think farmers are heroes.
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
But farmers typically are about the hardest working Americans, and you know if it rains they got to work. If it snows, if it's cold, if it's dry and hot, if there's the big game on, they got to work. You know they're always working, and they're doing it so that we can all eat and we can all come out to a place like this and eat and drink and have fun. They don't get days off. They don't get 2-week vacations. With their kids in the summer. That's when it's super busy. So we want them to be successful. So we're buying, we're trying to pay a fair rate for our apples and get our local family farmers to grow apples that we can afford to pay extra for. Cider fruit costs more. It should cost more. We're willing to pay more for it. And if we grow it ourselves, then we can't impact the community enough. So we like buying fruit. We'll always buy most of our fruit from other farmers. And we think that the more we can do that, the more we can kind of help out the state of Michigan and all the apple growers there. Right now, there's about 1,000 apple growers in the state of Michigan. 40 years ago, there were about 4,000 apple growers in the state of Michigan. We want to keep it around 1,000. We don't want to see it get down to like 300 or so. We wanted people growing apples and passing it down to the next generation. I was with two cider makers at Murray's, one who was fifth generation, one who was eighth generation. That doesn't happen in America anymore. That's very sad. How many generations are you, Steve? First generation. Me too. So, there you go. We're starting fresh.
Yeah. Start procreating.
We can procreate.
Right.
Get to it.
But, you know, there's a lot of the growers that we buy from in Michigan that are third or fourth generation. And they got kids that, you know, are probably not going to stay on the farm unless they can make money doing it. And they can't make money doing it if they're selling their apples to a processor who sells them to Tropicana, you know, for 89 cents a gallon. You know, if they're selling fruit for 6 cents a pound, which right now that's what fruit's going for in Michigan, there's no money there. You can't make a living. So, you know, if even at 12 cents a pound, which is kind of a more standard rate, you can't make a living on that. So we're willing to pay more for good fruit, and we think that if it makes our cider better, the public will go ahead and pay more for our cider. You know, and I think Steve's proved that works.
I have resolved not to interrupt this man, but I've got to tell you, what he just said is absolutely true, and I honor him for doing what he's doing. Growers can stay in business if somebody will pay them to grow the fruit. So nobody will ever plant an acre of processing apples for $2 a bushel when it takes $10,000 an acre to even get the thing in the ground. But if there are people who are willing to actually pay for the value of the fruit to go into these glasses, and Greg's in an extreme minority right now, but it's growing, that is going to have a significant effect on agricultural good orchard land in this country. So I raise my glass to this gentleman.
Cheers.
Absolutely.
Greg, I want to ask you this. So I know that you put a lot of time into, you know, studying and learning about the history of cider. Tell us about, like, the old days in America and what hard cider meant.
Well, you know, if you go back, certainly 300 years ago, there were more people drinking cider than every other beverage put together. Not alcoholic beverage, every other beverage put together. As the colonists started to move west, they generally had three things with them. You know, here's a shout out to the Second Amendment. They had their musket, they had their axe, their throwing axe, a shout out to my friend Michael over there, and they had apple seeds or a seedling tree. Because wherever they landed, wherever they homesteaded, you know, they needed to protect themselves, they needed to chop up wood, and they needed to make cider. They could not run down to Jimmy's 43 to get a pint. They couldn't go to Whole Foods and pick up a six-pack. They couldn't go to Top Hops and fill a growler. You know, if they wanted to drink something, they had kind of three choices. They could either, like, drink rainwater or groundwater, and there's risk there. They could drink milk if they brought a cow with them, and if they drank it like right from the cow, they were reasonably assured they wouldn't die immediately. And then they could make cider and be safe. When I went to brewing school, they wrote this on the chalkboard the first day. In wine is wisdom. They left out cider. But they said, in wine is wisdom, in beer is strength, in water is bacteria.
I like that.
Yes. So, you know, we all think of alcohol as being the fun time drink, but up until about 100 years ago, it was the life-giving drink. It was the drink you drank so you wouldn't die, because anything else you drank, you might die. Because you had no idea if it was going to be clean or not. You kind of expected it probably wouldn't be. So we're very lucky to have sources of fresh water and drinks everywhere all the time now. Access to them, especially in the U.S. But alcohol, you know, as many of us historians know, that the pilgrims land of the Mayflower in Plymouth Rock. Why? Because they ran out of beer. They didn't think Plymouth Rock was the best place to land. They just didn't have any more beer. And when you're going in a boat from England to across the ocean, you couldn't like buy a couple pallets of Evian. You know, you basically had to bring some booze with you so it would be safe. So cider's been part of America for a very long time. Really up until beer started getting really big in the 1870s, 1880s. And what happened then was people started going to the cities and production of beer became much more commercial and much more focused in the cities. And beer by nature is easier to produce in bulk because the raw materials of barley and corn and wheat are much easier to store than apples are. Cider's easier to produce on the farm because you don't need any specialized equipment. All you need is apples in a barrel, and you can make cider. But if you're going to make a big commercial amount of it, it's easier to make beer. So beer became big. Then they started doing these train things and being able to ship it all over, and cider started going away. And then with Prohibition, everybody knows about like the axe, you know, and they think it was like to bust up barrels. It was really to chop down apple trees. We lost, you know, somewhere between 50 to 60% of the apple trees in the Great Lakes region in Prohibition because the Prohibitionists chopped them down because apple trees meant cider. That's where kind of the apple industry came up with an apple a day and like bring an apple for your teacher. Apples weren't for eating until about 100 years ago. They were for making cider. In the good old days. So we're happy to bring those back. I grew up in suburban Chicago. We had a crab apple tree in our yard, and I thought they were the only thing they were for is thrown at my sister, but they were actually for making cider. Who knew back then?
Huge thanks to Greg Hall of Virtue Cider, Steve Woods of Farnham Hill, and Jimmy Carbone of Jimmy's Number 43 and Beer Sessions Radio for their help in this episode.
And Jimmy for hosting it at the restaurant.
Absolutely. It's a fantastic tasting, one of many that Jimmy has throughout the year.
And to all people who put on New York Cider Week, it's an awesome event. I think it's a second or third year running now. Really, really great things happening. I love it.
All right, we'll be back next week with part two of our kimchi show with Kimchi-licious Tony Limwako, and he's going to be talking about cooking with kimchi. So join us at 7 p.m. next week for Cooking with Kimchi with Tony Limwako on heritageradionetwork.org.
Forget about it.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.